Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning, everyone. You are now listening to The Brown Briefly, and that was the voice of our founder and mentor, Brian Brown. Until his death earlier this year, Brian presided for many years over an ever-growing team of political analysts and historians, humorists, activists, and general rabble-rousers still known as the Brieflies. We try to carry on Brian's legacy of edified civil discourse, leavened with humor and goodwill. Sometimes we make it, sometimes we don't. Join us as we approach each horrifying pre-election week together with our outraged disbelief, sobering statistics, rational compartmentalization, hopeful orientation, humorous releases of tension, and regaining of forward momentum, if not balance. And first, thanks, Truman, for that incredible tribute to Ruth Bader Ginsburg with the playing of The Parting Glass and Auld Lang Syne and Taps. That will be one of our lead stories today, and I'll come back to that. But first, it's the fall equinox, the first day of fall.
Yeah.
The planet's turning on us. It's roaring at us at an alarming rate. And yet, here we are, still on a little island off the edge of the left coast, zooming in to broadcast our take on the state of the nation. Drowned, smoked, or burned out, hungry, tired, or bored, we the people are not subdued. I'm your host today, Lynn Kerrigan. I'm a retired social worker, professor emeritus, out of shape, former athlete, poet, and enthusiastic musician, and a Northwest native with Southern childhood. I was outside a lot, and it taught me practicality and how to smell cow pies before I stepped in them. I find that a useful skill for this particular job.
Boy, isn't that the truth.
With me in the studio today is Truman O'Brien. I call him Pappy O'Brien, at the controls, whistling easy all the way, and just hot off his morning scramble this day. Truman piloted airplanes before he steered us onto the airwaves, which is easiest, Truman. And how about that rough air?
Oh, I tell you what, the turbulence in this show is far outweighs any turbulence I ever had in the air. not really, but...
the sudden drops.
Yes, those sudden drops that get you. But you guys are a delight to work with. It's been a real fun event for me and a real pleasure. So I enjoy it. Thanks.
We'll have to work on that.
Yeah.
From the far east edge of Vachon rides our mask avenger and guardian of the galaxy, historian, professor, and author Bruce Holman, who understands the value of a long view and international perspectives. Bruce, what's calling to you today?
Well, it's been interesting with RBG sort of stuff going.
Oh, Bruce, doggone it, you're cutting out again. You had that problem last week. Let's go on and we'll have to try and get Bruce to reconnect here.
Yeah, we'll go on to Susan. Also present is Vachon's own feminist producer and own star public radio interviewer, Susan McCabe, co-editor of the Vachon Whole Catalog, moderator of the Suicide Awareness Campaign, held a couple of years ago at Vachon Center for the Arts, and host of the upcoming Real Talk, which follows this show. What's up for you, Susan? And we'll cycle back to you, Bruce.
Well, that suicide prevention panel was just a couple of weeks ago, not a couple of years ago.
Weeks, I'm sorry. I thought I said that. I'm slurring.
That's okay. And Truman, thank you. I didn't know I'd have to bring a hanky to this particular episode of Brieflies, but that tribute to RBG was... motivated tears. And I will tell you that it's hard to know on Real Talk what issue to talk about, but today I am encoring a very interesting interview with Amy Irving, author of Waking Up White.
Oh, Excellent.
That'll be a theme today.
I have not heard of that one. I'm going to listen to that. I look forward to it. Thank you.
Good for us white folks who want to be allies to people of color.
Right. Thank you. And Bruce, do you have your sound back?
Yeah, I do.
Great.
For some reason it froze up. The nature of being on Zoom, right?
Yeah.
So I've been working on a, we're doing a talk with a transgender political scientist on October 8th about the election and elections on Vashon, and looking at the 1920 election and the 1916 election, and of course, 1918 election, that was a midterm election that took place during the pandemic. And it's interesting how little things have changed to a certain extent, and how much the 1920 election, after the 1918 pandemic, influenza pandemic, was a real return to sort of what was characterized as normalcy. There was a real push after a period of reform, after a period of World War I, for things to get back to normal. And that heartens me as we approach this election 6 weeks down the line, that people are kind of tired of this chaotic presidency that we've had in the chaotic last 4 years and a pandemic that's out of control. And that maybe what people will be looking for is somebody stable like President Biden could be.
President Biden could be. I like that. Good save there, Bruce. No, I think that's important work, and I look forward to that perspective. That'll be wonderful. And last in the studio here is also Kevin Jones, representing Indivisible Vashon. My mouth is not working yet this morning. That's a problem when you live alone and don't talk to people early on. Come into the studio and my mouth won't work. Kevin, I know you're the voice of the Opportunities for Progressive Activism, and I've seen your name signed on your cards. Kevin, a volunteer, that will be your new nickname. Looks like the numbers are swinging all over, Kevin. What else is on your mind? How do we set our priorities, in your opinion?
Great question, Lynn. Indeed, things are changing. And I will just say Indivisible with liberty and justice for all, so that we understand how that name came into being and what we hope to achieve. This is a little bit of a preview, just a look ahead. Next week on this day, we have the presidential debate, the very first one. And then a week after that, Susan and I are going to go in depth, I think, into this topic.
But yay.
Just so we know that there's some really important battleground states. And the great news is that hovering around a 6% lead is our current president, future President Biden, in the key states of Michigan and Wisconsin, and right around 4% in Wisconsin, which is, I'm sorry, Pennsylvania, which is dropping a bit. So we need to, you know, help boost his chances there in Pennsylvania. Florida is sort of looking like Florida and not quite as promising as we were hoping. It's currently around a 1%, clearly in the margin of error. Any one of those first three states, if Biden wins, he's very likely to have the White House.
Wow.
And the thing in the Senate that I'll just mention is that we're tracking a bunch of different states, and the Senate is definitely in play. And the thing that was just amazing to me last week is that there are now what I call my insurance policy states. These are states that will allow us to actually control the Senate. There's now five states competing for that honor. Whereas before there were only one or two. And so the map is really in play. The states that we're focused on, we largely see candidates running about 5% ahead in those states, which would allow us to tie. And then, of course, we would have avoided the jeopardy of conservative judicial appointments, because our vice president would come in as the tiebreaker. So I'm encouraged. And thanks for asking.
Great. We'll come back to some of those principles when we're talking a little bit more about some of our other issues today. So let me kind of introduce some possibilities today.
Sorry, I had to step out just for a minute. But did we say that Michael's not here today?
Oh, I did not. Thank you.
We should say that real
quick. Yes, we should. Our last permanent member Michael Shook is not with us today. He's dealing with a well pump problem at home. He's our erudite carpenter and landscape artist, actor and singer, and all-around philosopher. So we'll miss him, Michael. You'll have to double up next week. So this week I've been looking at the mound of political excrement that boggles my mind. I'm convinced they try to boggle our mind, and it's up to stench level in these muggy days prior to the election in November. In a brief review of some of this week's media, looking at the Turkish tactics to control information for voters, one is the decision to call seditious the protesters in the Black Lives Matter movement in Seattle, as well as our mayor, Jenny Durgan, by the federal government. Sedition is a new term. Now we're also an anarchist jurisdiction. There's also been attempts by the attorney general to rebuke his own lawyers that are following the law and issuing stay-at-home orders and injunctions across the country at the bidding of their governors. There's also switcheroo messaging from the Health and Human Services and the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, after somebody had a big meltdown calling scientists evil geniuses for trying to hold up the vaccine development because they want to replace the president. And continuing disinformation that's been reported in The New Yorker by not only our pals the Russians, but Fox News and other local outlets. And then, at the end of the week, was the shock and the tragic timing of the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Oh, man, the woman who's led the four-person liberal bloc of the Supreme Court for so many years and been so articulate in her dissents. We lament and honor her today, such a champion for equal justice for women. And there's a lot of implications about her death and the coveted Supreme Court vacancy now open that could take the sort of balanced 4-5 numbers in the liberal and conservative ends, with John Roberts often swinging those votes, sometimes to the liberal stand. And now McConnell is stating that he's going to fill this vacancy right now. I'd love to hear us talking a little bit about these tactics, these rationales, and help people understand what's going on, you know, with the implications of all this. Somebody willing to leap in?
Yeah, let me just jump in to start. I mean, let's not be surprised. I mean, when you have a winner-take-all, you know, 51%, you win everything, sort of political system rather than a representative system or a system that allows minority parties and third parties to have a voice. Whoever has the power can do what they want. It's the nature of the system that we have. Now, we can lament that and we can, you know, pull our hair if we had any, that kind of stuff. But the reality is that's the system that we have. And you know, if the situation was reversed, would it be any different? You know, that's what you have to ask. And I suspect it wouldn't. You know, it's just the nature of a winner-take-all political system. And, you know, there are alternatives, but right now that's the system we have.
And, you know, the...
Susan, what do you think of the notion that I think some Democrats are floating, that even if Trump manages to drive a conservative justice on to replace RBG, what about the notion of increasing the size of the Supreme Court?
Sure. Franklin D. Roosevelt tried that in 1937. And it didn't go anywhere. You know, the American people were very, very reluctant to have a partisan sort of, you know, increasing the court just to meet partisan sort of interest. I suspect the same thing would happen. I'm less worried than a lot of people. I mean, Supreme Court justices, once they're appointed, tend to change. I mean, you have to remember Earl Warren was the governor of California who avidly supported, exiling and imprisoning the Japanese during World War II, and less than 10 years later, he's the lead voice in Brown versus the Board of Education. So the Supreme Court changes people. And another thing that, just from my perspective, is we tend to focus on Roe versus Wade, and I think that's the wrong focus, because Roe versus Wade is a Supreme Court decision. If we really want to have reproductive rights for everyone, we have either law as through Congress, and then it's not up to the courts. As long as we rely on the courts for reproductive rights, it's going to be a crapshoot. And that's not the way to do it. We need to have a constitutional amendment that guarantees women's rights, or we need to have a law that guarantees women's rights.
Thank you, Bruce. Truman, you were trying to get something into.
No, the only thing I was going to say is about, and I agree with you, Bruce, 100% on everything you said. The thing that really bothers me is, I don't care if they want to push through a candidate now. What I care about, though, is the fact that in 16, they were saying, no, absolutely, we can't do that. I mean, it's just that we're just completely unacceptable for like 10 months. And now they're saying, oh, yeah, we're going to just do that. That really bothers me. I mean, if they hadn't done that.
Hypocrisy.
Complete hypocrisy. I mean, that bothers me.
I watched Mitch McConnell state that rationale where he was actually saying, yes, but what Bruce said, then that was when we did not have a president on our side and you were asking a political party to do something they didn't want to do. And now we have both the Senate and the president. And so we will do what we want. So they're unashamedly changing their tactic. Kevin.
Kevin, you're muted.
Thank you. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Great. I think that Lindsey Graham is sort of the most amazing on record saying that, if ever any president tries to nominate a Supreme Court justice in the last year of the presidency, I'm on record saying that's completely wrong. And of course, he now chairs the Judiciary Committee where he's all on, right, moving forward. It also turns out that his latest poll with his challenger Jamie Harrison is he is tied, and that's one of those states that's now sort of in the play to flip the Senate. So I'm really curious, where does this go? I think about all of the things, despite Bruce, your assurances that the judicial appointments do change people's outlooks, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg had such a powerful movement on voting rights, LGBTQ, marriage rights, school segregation, racial justice, the Affordable Care Act, all of those things are really in play. And some folks who vote today just don't know the long road that we've walked down to assure these privileges, these benefits, that we have. And for the hypocrisy and the accelerated move to put more conservative justices on the bench who do threaten these things has to play out one way or the other in terms of the American populace and how they look at our leaders. And I don't know quite what the calculus is right now. Will it affect the presidential race? I think it's going to become just one more element of concern in the presidential race. There's still the question of whether they vote before or after the election. I noticed that Senator Collins was happy to say we should wait until after the presidential election. That means they're waiting until after her election, and she is being held to task by her vote for Kavanaugh already by the citizens of Maine. So she'd love to have that vote happen after the election so she can basically retain her seat and then vote for a conservative justice. So there's a lot of things going on in play here. I find it quite fascinating to watch.
Susan?
The other scary piece is that McConnell's mission, which has well accomplished, has been to stuff courts nationwide with conservative judges. And so those courts of appeal and those lower courts could do a whole lot more damage before anything gets to the Supreme Court. And he's done that quietly behind the scenes while distracting us with all kinds of other crap.
Mm.
What did you call it, Lynn?
My various terms of political excrement, you mean?
Yes.
I'm trying to avoid the seven words that
not allowed.
Get you banned, because I've already broken one of them. And so I had fun today thinking of how many ways to say muckraking. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So Bruce, my question to you is, I understand what you're saying about the Supreme Court, but what about increasing the number of federal judges? Where they also talked about that as a possibility, and going from 70 to 100 and some odd.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, right. And to me, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, you look at our federal court system and the system of appeals courts, regional appeal courts, you know, they're overwhelmed. It was designed for
Sorry, Bruce is cutting out again.
Duck on it, Bruce, we're losing you again. I don't know what's going on with your connection today.
No, I don't either. Yeah. Sorry, guys.
Bruce and I are neighbors. We live at the very edge of the island down a hill. So I'm always amazed that you have good Zoom coverage.
So am I back on or not?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah. No, I think there's good reason to increase the number of judges and appeal court sort of districts, you know, at the federal level. Right. I mean, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
That's hopeful. I didn't realize that. That was a possibility. Is it easier? I presume it's easier to do than increasing the number of seats on the Supreme Court.
Yep, right, yep, yep.
I like that idea.
Let me ask y'all another question. One of the things I thought about as I was listening to all the various news media in the last couple of days that have talked about senators who had initially said they do not believe in bringing this to a vote during this particular electoral season. They believed in having the people. And so I was hopeful, I guess, earlier that Romney and that Cory Gardner from Colorado and Chuck Grassley, those were also people that were considering joining the brave souls, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, in saying they did not think that this was the right time to bring the candidate for the Supreme Court forward to the people. And then in the last 24 hours, three of those converted their opinions to saying they will follow the McConnell-Trump way. So Grassley and Gardner and Romney have now said they'd support it. My question is, it makes me wonder what kind of pressures were brought to bear or what's coming down the pike earlier that they may have been promised or threatened with. Truman.
Yeah, I've really focused on what Bruce was saying. Mm-hmm. They could bring out a candidate after the election, and no matter who wins. And it didn't dawn on me until Bruce said that, hey, these folks are covering their own elections. I mean, if they throw in right now saying we should not do it before the election, they're not saying anything about after. And right. So even if Trump loses and he's a lame duck president, he could still appoint. I mean, there's nothing to stop him, right, Bruce? Yeah. I mean, I was thinking, oh, well, good for them. But it doesn't really matter whether they are on board or not, if you think about it.
Well, only in the sense of, you know, having different sort of senators in place only after the inauguration and all of that. So yeah, there is a long dead space there. You're right.
Yeah. And they could be using this as their own propaganda for their own elections. You know?
Kevin, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it is. It is really sort of amazing. I think Romney's the bellwether of those that you listed, given that he has sort of played this middle of the road senator in the past. You mentioned Gardner. He's currently running 8 points behind Hickenlooper, and Arizona is a little hard to tell because we've had numbers that range anywhere from 8 to 12 to now 6%. or McSally in Arizona, who is also a trunk acolyte who has a really tight race. So, you know, there are certain senators who are pretty, very unlikely they're going to actually win their elections. And so I'm curious at the calculus if they see that supporting Trump in this case is really a boost to their electoral prospects, or if they're just sort of saying, you know, I'm not going to win this, but I have a long-term plan maybe in the Republican Party of Trump in the future. And so maybe that's something that they're banking on.
Very kind, generous thoughts about how people have to think during the political season. It's quite terrifying, if you ask me. Bruce, are you back online with sound yet?
Sure.
I guess I wanted to say one thing about, you know, when you mentioned that the focus on Roe versus Wade may, you know, not be the necessarily the best tactic, you know, for Democrats to be worried about or taking up right now, because you're saying, you know, that we really need a constitutional amendment or a different way of addressing equal rights for women, perhaps. But it made me wonder about the health care question, because it seems like Biden is really focusing on the implications of what's going to happen if the Republicans continue to try to take pot shots, if not eliminate the Affordable Care Act, in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, that seems on the face of it an extremely wise thing to do on Biden's part, to really remind people that nobody's really much backed health care and everyone is sick. And so everybody think a little bit more about how in the world we survive if Affordable Care Act left. And I keep hearing Trump is saying he's got a plan about ready to go. Has anybody got anything to say about all of that and the kind of leverage that healthcare may or may not give us in this election?
Can we say snake oil?
Yes, you can. In which glass?
Yeah. This is like the 89th pronouncement from the president.
Yeah.
That we have a great health care plan. We're going to roll it out in just the next 12 to 14 days.
This is the longest 2 weeks I think we've ever experienced.
God, yes. You know, I've been reading about how health care was so important at the midterm elections. And of course, now in the midst of a pandemic, he's still looking at killing Obamacare, which kills the option for allowing people with pre-existing conditions to get insurance. And the pandemic or COVID-19 can be considered a pre-existing condition. It seems like he's actually shooting himself in the foot with that notion, that approach to healthcare. And let's hope that he does.
Truman.
No, I was just going to, say, yeah, that COVID-19 is going to be one of those pre-existing conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I was just going to say that I had heard Biden's speech talking about how important healthcare is going to be. And it looks like he's honing in on the climate and healthcare as his two main cards he wants to bring to this poker game. Go ahead.
Well, we are witnessing the effects of both very personally, very directly right now. There was one other thing that, unfortunately, it wasn't on your list yet, Lynn, because it kind of happened this morning, but that's what's going on at the UN right now. I think it's a UN general session, and Trump is shooting us in the foot once again, and basically isolating the United States from the rest of the world. Certain pundits are predicting that where Trump and the United States create a vacuum, President Xi and China are going to fill it in. What do you guys think about the impact of that on the United States' global status?
Thanks for bringing that up, Susan. I've heard a little bit about that on NPR this morning, so I'll just throw out the statement that stayed with me. Was whoever the commentator was, he said it is very dangerous to start getting us into a cold war again and with China, who is one of our main trading partners, in addition to, you know, having a lot of things we disagree with around human rights, and that, you know, there's a void that we have caused by dropping out of WHO, as well as, you know, this this group within the United Nations, and they will fill a vacuum. Anybody else, Kevin?
You know, it's kind of amazing to me that the policies that that our current president is pushing really, you know, roll us back to, you know, days in the 50s where, you know, car emissions are something to be forgiven, and coal is something you should dig out of the ground and burn. And the real world is moving towards, right, zero emission vehicles and alternatives for renewable energy to be able to heat our homes and power our lights. And the economic disadvantage and the intellectual property losses, right, that creates, the loss of investment interest in moving in that direction, that's caused by presidential statements like that. I hope the markets in the country are actually not paying attention to what the president is saying, because if all of our industry, you know, we had to rescue the car industry in 08, right, in 09. And a U.S. automobile manufacturing industry that is big cars that burn gas, when almost every other manufacturer on the planet is going to move to electrical vehicles. And guess what? The 190 odd countries who have signed onto the Paris Agreement to reduce carbon emissions are really going to incentivize their people buying cars that are run not on fossil fuels. And so they're basically looking at giving up their market if they don't remain competitive. And it's just astounding to me that would be the outcome. And so I hope that despite the rhetoric, our industries and technologists and scientists are looking to a better future for us.
I just think of it as so much short-term thinking, you know, that where are we with our five-year plans and our 10-year plans and our regard for our seven generations? I was always struck by the philosophy that some Native American tribes used, and I think this came out around the relook at the Iroquois Confederacy when the biennial happened here in 1976, and we went back and looked at some of the framing principles. And one of the things that some I wish I could cite this really badly, and I hope I say it right, but that some, I have heard some Native American statements of that time saying that the U.S. seems to plan for one generation and take seven generations to pay for it, and the Native American population plan for seven generations and kind of lived in the present, not the future. And I was struck by that, and I hope I haven't butchered it too badly, just with the sense of short-term greed seems like it's running everything, and maybe that's just the nature of power. Always makes me worry if they know something we don't about the climate change clock. Bruce, any thoughts on, you know, the kind of Cold War and, you know, places that we are headed and could and shouldn't be? Uh-oh.
No, sorry. There you go.
There he is.
Sorry. I've got my grandkids downstairs, so it's sort of like I'm trying to keep
hearing the laughter of small children. It's kind of nice.
Yeah. You know, my sense is Trump has seriously damaged America's reputation in the world. And it's not, I mean, it's not surprising anytime you get a nativist, you know, America first kind of approach to things, particularly in this global environment we're in today, it's going to diminish the impact that the United States has in the world. And then, you know, the Cold War, the post-World War II period was devastating. I mean, in terms of what it took out of the country in terms of resources into the military, rather than going into economic development and human rights and schools and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, a new Cold War would be devastating to the American economy. We already have a huge military, and increase it against a country like China, just disastrous. So I think it's a serious mistake to move the direction we're moving right now.
Kevin.
You know, Bruce, I think it's a really excellent question you asked, Lynn, and the notion that we have this reputation now, which is tarnished at least and damaged at best. And what, Bruce, what does history tell us about how long it takes to recover? Is it the same as, you know, it takes, 10 attaboys to wipe out one aw shucks, or is it maybe more rapid than that?
I mean, it's difficult to interpret because you haven't seen it very much, but you look at, you know, if you look at world history and you look at the emergence of Spain as the dominant world power, you know, in the 15th, 16th century, and then Britain emerging in the 18th and 19th century, the United States emerging in the 20th century, China emerging in the 21st century. I mean, you know, Spain is still a player, but not a major player. You know, Britain still a player, not a major player. The United States still a player, but, you know, within 40 to 50 years, we're not going to be the major player we were through the 20th century. And so when you look at history, and from my perspective in world history, the rise and diminishing of empires is sort of, you know, it's a cyclical kind of thing. United States has been in an unenviable position of having huge natural resources, you know, to be able to sustain itself, but so does China. You know, and China has the population that we don't have. And so, you know, I think a Cold War with China is going to be a disaster for the United States.
Would we not be in a Cold War with Russia if the president didn't like him so much, like Putin so much? I mean, I'm just thinking about all of the disinformation and kind of things that have alarmed so many people in this country, and that minor sanctions don't seem to be doing anything to stop his poisonings and all of that. And it sounds like that the minute some scientists decide there's possibly life on Venus, the Russians declare it a Russian planet. That's right. So they can, what, go out and extract whatever minerals they find there? So this war is happening, and it's taking, you know, interplanetary dimensions. I hope I can telepathically communicate with my grandchildren in 50 years. Susan, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking about Barack Obama, and when he was president, I think he recognized that other nations were growing to be equal partners with the United States, and he was trying to lead us to the point of joining the Brotherhood of Nations and not being so focused on being a superpower. Unfortunately, all that went awry when Trump took office, but I think it would be healthy for us and for the world to join the Brotherhood of Nations and get back into the Paris Accord, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whether that will actually happen, I don't know. I bet you read this today, Truman, and that was in Heather Cox Richardson's letter to Americans Today. And she brought up something that an investigative journalist from Vanity Fair found. Suspicious activity reports filed by banks with the Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. And one of the things they found, it was more than $2 trillion in potentially laundered money between 1999 and 2017, particularly Russian money going to the United States in 2016. They're not naming Trump, but it's coming through Deutsche Bank, which is Trump's bank. Or did. And it was $1.3 trillion that made bankers nervous about money coming from Russia into the United States. The reason I brought that up was our comment about greed and oligarchs running the planet and Russia doing things like claiming that Venus belongs to them. It is all about the oligarchs who are basically running the world, and how much money do they need?
Yeah.
You know, I've this is not a new thought. It's been on my mind for a few decades of, you know, as a person growing up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on, and still seeing a lot of huge prosperity in the United States with a relatively small percentage of the population, but consuming a outsized portion of the resources of the world.
Right.
And that is an equation for unsustainability, right? So eventually you get to the point of a reckoning. And my thought of 20 years ago or more was, eventually I'm going to have to live through this reckoning, and I just don't know what it's going to look like. But I wonder if that's now exactly what we're seeing, right? In terms of the, you know, potentially, is it largesse in the country where we're on top? We don't feel we have to compete. Those who are not on top or feel motivated every day to compete. Now we have, you know, the challenge of being able to maintain our position. We seem to have a president who's trying to maintain a standard of living by hearkening back to the good old days, right? When we all had lots of money to spare, although obviously lots of groups didn't benefit from that. And I think he's just still attached to an unsustainable future. And the, adjoining the world of, you know, governments and markets is, Susan, it seems to me, is a way, well, we may still see our standard of living adjust downward as we have more equity across that global market. It's certainly maybe not the crash that we're now potentially sitting on when our intellectual property becomes stale because we're not investing and we don't have those global markets. I'm curious what people think about where we're headed here.
Wow, Kevin, that was meaty. Thank you so much. The thought that I had as you were talking is that this seems to me all connected into some giant post-colonial reckoning. So you're right, I think, Kevin, in that with a giant superpower, there's nowhere to go but down. Everybody wants their boats floated upward. That was what globalization and trade was supposed to do, lift all boats, and instead it concentrated wealth, right, with the oligarchs. And now we are fighting to see whose oligarchs are going to take over post-colonial, whatever we call, you know, the running of the world, the order of the world. And yet we still have the vote. You know, there are more of us than more of them. We can change the Senate. We can change the presidency and lurch us back onto a different track if we but have the will to get up in the morning and turn out to vote or send in those ballots. And by the way, Washington Vashonians, we do not have to request a ballot. That was the other thing that happened last week. The notice from the feds came out to request your mail-in ballot. Yours will be sent automatically. But I'm kind of just, you know, wanting to say Black Lives Matter. All of those brown and black countries matter. They are asking for their time and space. So, anybody else have any parting comments? We've got about 2 minutes left, and there's so much going on. What you're still digesting and chewing on?
Well, still, the notion of a reckoning, I think, is what we're actually living through right now. And it makes me think of the idea of, I don't fear death, it's the transition that bothers me. And when you say reckoning, I think we need that. We need, and we need to come to what really works for humanity, the humanity that has so overpopulated the earth that we're consuming it. Where the heck do we go from here? And what is that transition going to be like to get to the other side?
That's right. And do we want a party in power that incarcerates and jails and cages people that they don't agree with? I don't think so.
Yeah, that's another whole question.
Yeah, and in the meantime, Lynn, as you mentioned, you know, we have the power of the vote. We have the power to communicate with others about that power. I'll hold up my stack of postcards. I just bought another 500. I figure I can write 1,200 postcards between now and when the mailing dates sort of curtail. We can all reach out and let people know how critical it is, the things that we need to gain so that we can avoid these losses that are staring us in the face.
Well, we'll give it another shot on next week and see how we do. But right now, I'm hearing the foghorns and going to say Good day. Have a good week.
You all.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks, everybody, for listening.